TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Authoritarian Absurdity of the U.S. Constitution. Paul Street on Why It Matters Today. Paul Street is an independent, radical democratic policy researcher, teacher, journalist, historian, and author of 7 books. In this talk that he gave at the Open University of the Left in Chicago in March 2019, he offered arguments and proof that the U.S. Constitution is not the sacred document protecting the people's rights, but on the contrary, is authoritarian and anti-democratic by design. For the 18th century slaveholders and merchants, popular sovereignty was the ultimate nightmare, and they embedded safety mechanisms into the Constitution that remain in force today via the Senate, Supreme Court, and Electoral College. Street details how U.S. politics and policy are badly distorted by the nation's exceptionally durable charter, and how we might finally stop playing Simon Says with militant anti-democrats like Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. Here's Paul Street.
We do live in an insane historical moment, if you don't mind me saying so. Inequality so extreme now that 3 absurdly rich people possess as much wealth between them as the bottom half of the population in the U.S. Economic power so concentrated that you can count on one hand the multi-trillion dollar financial institutions that control the nation's economic and political assets. 6 corporations together own more than half U.S. print electronic media. 3 internet giants, Google, Facebook, Amazon, rule online communications and shopping. The presidency held by a malignant, narcissist, creeping fascist, pseudo-billionaire most of the nation hates. He pretends to be a populist while doing everything he can to distribute wealth, power further upward. We have been hearing constantly for 2+ years that Russia undermined our so-called democracy, but majority public opinion has been essentially irrelevant in the American oligarchy for decades. In his response to Donald Trump's State of the Union address, Bernie Sanders cited one poll after another showing that most Americans support progressive social democratic things like single-payer health insurance, free college tuition, workers' rights to organize, collectively bargain, a doubling of the minimum wage, progressive taxation, green jobs programs to give people decent employment while helping, by the way, save the planet. Bernie could have added that most U.S. millennials and now most Democrats tell pollsters that they prefer socialism to capitalism. Imagine that. Great. So what? Who cares? In the United States, a recent authoritative political science text reports, quote, government policy reflects the wishes of those with money, not the wishes of millions of ordinary citizens who turn out every 2 years to choose among the pre-approved, money-vetted candidates for federal office. In 2019, as in 2015, Sanders is the only remotely viable presidential candidate actually running in accord with majority public opinion, but the notion of him getting a major party presidential nomination is in all likelihood, again, a pipe dream. The Democratic Party isn't about social and economic justice, democracy, or ecological survival. It isn't even mainly about winning elections. It's about serving and colluding with corporate sponsors and climbing the neoliberal capitalist oligarchy. Think Bill, NAFTA, Clinton, the multimillionaire head of the Clinton Foundation. Think Barack, Trans-Pacific Partnership Obama, who has entered the economic oligarchy now as a reward for his dutiful service to the nation's unelected dictatorship of capital. I've said it before, I'll say it again. The dismal, dollar-drenched Democrats prefer losing to the right, even a creeping fascist white nationalist right, over losing to the left, even the explicitly non-radical social democratic left in their own party. Forget the politicians, George Carlin used to say. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't, Carlin said. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything, Carlin said. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets, and they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and the information you get to hear. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want, more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you, George Carlin continued, what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around a kitchen table and think about how badly they're getting f***ed by a system that threw them overboard 30 years ago. It's called the American dream, George Carlin said, because you have to be asleep to believe it. In the nation's reigning, dollar-drenched party and election system, as in its legal system, as in its media system, as in its educational systems, including its college entrance systems, as we were recently reminded, money talks and boat walks. Now I'll say something really scandalous. If you put on your historical earbud and listen hard through the ages, you just might hear the United States' big, wealthy, powdered wig-wearing, merchant capitalist and slave-owning founding fathers laughing about this big, messy state of class rule that we are in. I'm always amused when I hear some political talking head denounce some modern-day plutocratic outrage as contrary to the noble and democratic intent of our holy founding fathers. It's total nonsense. People need to do their damn history. Democracy, the rule of the majority, was the last thing the nation's aristo-republican founders wanted to see break out in their infant republic. Drawn from the elite property segments in the new nation, most of the delegates to the 1787 Constitutional Convention shared their compatriot John Jay's view that those, quote, who owned the country ought to govern it. As celebrated U.S. historian Richard Hofstadter noted in his classic 1948 text, the first serious history book I ever read, The American Political Tradition and the Men Who Made It, in their minds, Hofstadter wrote, liberty was linked not to democracy, but to property. Democracy was a profoundly dangerous concept to the framers, to the young nation's architect. Democracy meant, and here I'm quoting Hofstadter, unchecked rule by the masses. It was certain, in Hofstadter's word, to, quote, bring arbitrary redistribution of property, destroying the very essence of liberty. Liberty was about property, not democracy, to the founders. As constitutional historian Jennifer Nadelsky notes, protection of property, meaning the people who own large amounts of it, was the main object of government for all but one of the United States Constitution's framers, Lonely James Wilson. The non-affluent majority was for the founders what Nadelsky calls a problem to be contained. We the people were a problem to be contained in the view of the founding fathers. And anyone who doubts that and doubts the militantly anti-democratic character of the founders' worldview, all they got to do is go read, if you think I'm lying, all you got to do is go read the Federalist Papers, written by the leading advocates of the U.S. Constitution to garner support for their preferred, more centralized form of national government to surpass the Articles of Confederation in 1787 and 1788. In Federalist No. 10, Holy Founder James Madison argued that democracies were, quote, spectacles of turbulence, incompatible with the rights of property. Democratic governments gave rise, Madison wrote, to factious leaders who could kindle a flame among dangerous masses for wicked tragics, like the abolition of debts and, horrors of horrors, a more equal division of property. Okay? This isn't, you know, Michael Parenti or some radical Marxist in the 20th century writing about those horrible, terrible founders. This is the founders themselves in language that can be found in the Federalist Papers. Extend the geographic sphere of the U.S. Republic, Madison wrote, and it will joyfully become more difficult for all who feel it to discover their own strength and act in union with each other. A big republic would be good because it would spread people out further and make it less likely that they would actually be able to unite and fight collectively for their class interests from the bottom up. At the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, Madison called for an upper U.S. Legislative Assembly, an American House of Lords, comprised of elite property holders, which is, of course, the U.S. Senate. The Senate, he hoped, would checkmate a coming rise in the proportion of Americans who will labor, Madison wrote, under all the hardships of life, and who will secretly sigh, Madison wrote, for a more equal distribution of its blessings, of life's blessings. In other words, that they'll call for a more equal, egalitarian distribution of property and wealth. Madison worried that the propertyless and property-poor American majority might in time, quote, outnumber those who are placed above them. According to the equal laws of suffrage, Madison warned, the power will slide into the hands of the non-affluent. And what a disaster that would be. What a disaster democracy would be. What a disaster it would be if the propertyless and property-poor majority actually ruled, if we had popular governance. My favorite Federalist paper, though, is number 35 by Alexander Hamilton, the future first U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. Hamilton argued that the common people found their proper representatives among the small class of wealthy merchant capitalists. The idea of an actual representation of all classes of people by persons of each class, Hamilton wrote, is altogether visionary. The weight and superior acquirements of the merchants render them more equal than the other classes, wrote Hamilton. Their superior weight and vision render them more equal than the propertyless majority. Somebody please tell Broadway's Lin-Manuel Miranda about the language in Federalist number 35. Alexander Hamilton was not only not Puerto Rican and not black, he was white. Not only that, he was a militantly anti-democratic classist. The New England clergyman Jeremy Belknap captured the fundamental idea behind the U.S. founders' notion of what they like to call popular government. Let it stand as a principle, Belknap wrote to an associate in the late 1780s as they were deliberating on the Constitution. Let it stand as a principle that government originates from the people, but let the people be taught that they are unable to govern themselves. The sovereignty of government emanates from you. You, however, are unable to govern yourselves. But of course, it wasn't just about teaching the people that they were incapable of self-rule. Their Holy Constitution was designed to make sure that the popular majority couldn't govern it self, even if it thought it could. And so the rich white fathers, our holy founders, crafted a form of government that was a monument to popular incapacitation, with the explicit stated purpose of keeping the majority and the specter of democracy at bay. Constitution divided the federal government into three parts, with just one half of one of those three parts, the House of Representatives, elected directly by the people, a category that, of course, at the time excluded blacks, women, Native Americans, and propertyless white males. In other words, it excluded most of the human beings living in the early republic. The Constitution set up elaborate checks and balances to prevent the possibility of the laboring multitude influencing policy. It introduced a system of rigidly fixed, steeply time-staggered elections, 2 years for the House, 6 years for the Senate, 4 years for the presidency, precisely to discourage sweeping all at once popular electoral rebellions. That's explicitly the purpose, to prevent that from happening in the discussions in the Constitutional Convention. They created a Supreme Court appointed for life by the president with confirmation restricted to the upper chamber of propertied elites. And the High Court was granted veto power over legislation or executive actions that might too strongly bear the imprint of the wretched multitude, the propertyless and property poor rabble who might secretly sigh for the more egalitarian distribution of wealth. The Constitution's curious and bizarre, and if you're from the United States, it's always fun to try to explain the Electoral College to people from other countries. And they're like, huh? The Constitution's curious Electoral College innovation guaranteed that the popular majority would not directly select the U.S. president, even on the limited basis of one vote for each propertied white male at the time. And of course, as we all so painfully know, the Electoral College is still in effect. You know, they were very excited about the checks and balances they had between the different branches of government. You know, the founders fantasized that they had crafted a form of governance in which parties would never emerge. They believed that there would never be any parties. And of course, the funny things about it is that the nation's first parties formed precisely around the debate over the Constitution and then funding and assumption and other things in the 1790s. Checks and balances between the different branches don't mean very much when one party controls all or most of the branches, as has occurred repeatedly in American history, and as still sort of goes on, except for one half of the Congress, that is the House of Representatives right now. Now, it's true that the Constitution's Article 5 provides a mechanism technically permitting we the people to alter the nation's charter, but the process for amending the U.S. Constitution was and remains exceedingly difficult, short of revolution and or civil war. As a progressive constitution critic Daniel Lazare has observed, moments after establishing the people as the omnipotent makers and breakers of constitutions, the Constitution announced that changing so much as a comma of the Constitution would require the approval of two-thirds of each House of Congress plus three-fourths of the state. The people did not assert their sovereignty in 1787, rather the founders invoked it. Once they uttered the magic incantation, they hastened to put the genie back in the bottle by declaring the people all but powerless to alter their own government. Now, you know, progressives have long advocated constitutional amendments to more properly align our politics and our policy with public opinion, but Article 5 is typically just too steep a barrier, and that's on purpose. Under its rule today, 13 of the nation's 50 states can disallow constitutional changes while containing just 4% of the nation's population. You stop constitutional amendment with 13 states, and you can go find 13 states that have 4% of the whole population. So states containing 1 in 25 Americans altogether can veto a constitutional amendment. It took the secession and military defeat of the slave South between 1861 and 1865 to pass amendments abolishing slavery and granting citizenship and suffrage to black human beings in the U.S. South. And of course, much of that was subsequently rolled back and sort of a de facto form of slavery and disenfranchisement was instituted in the late 19th century in the Jim Crow era. Now, the Constitution is no small part of how a majority progressive nation. I mean, it's one of the stunning things about us. If you look at the public opinion data, the surveys on policy, the majority of the country is like Bernie Sanders social democrats, a kind of left-center progressive. The Constitution's part of how such a country that votes primarily with not so much enthusiasm, but primarily for centrist Democrats is ruled by arch-reactionary white nationalist Republicans. So what if the GOP is viewed unfavorably by 60% of the U.S. population? The Electoral College renders the overall popular presidential vote largely irrelevant. It gives each state an extra vote for both senators that they send to Washington, no matter how small their populations are. The Electoral College triples the clout of the nation's eight smallest states and doubles that of the next six smallest states relative to their populations. For The fifth time in history and the second in this century, 2 years ago, the democracy-flunking Electoral College installed a president who failed to win the popular vote. In Trump's case, by 3 million votes. That's the biggest all-time popular vote losing president of all time. And I'm not trying to express any particular sympathy for Hillary Clinton because she knew the rules of the game going in. You know, this is the Electoral College rules are pretty clear. Fenway Park is a goofy ballpark, but if you can hit a ball, it would be a home run in Wrigley Field, and it's going to bounce off the big green monster in Fenway and could be a single. And she didn't play the game the right way. Okay, so I'm not feeling sorry for her, but anyway, Trump's in there, and he lost the popular vote by 3 million votes. The creeping fascist Donald Trump made it into the world's most powerful job, thanks in part to the Electoral College, which renders presidential campaigning irrelevant and close to non-existent in most of the nation. If most of you are longtime, full-time Illinoisians, and unlike me, have never lived in a contested state, I have. I've lived years in Iowa. Most of my life, I've lived in uncontested states. Uncontested states, you don't know what a presidential election is. You really don't. You might have an idea of it from TV. We're down to about, what, 12 states now, 15 states that actually have a presidential election. But thanks to the Electoral College, why bother? Illinois is blue in advance, which means all the electors are going blue. Why really bother with the Deep South? They're already red in advance, which means all the electors are going on the Republican side. It's only places like North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio. Now, there's some of these purplish states. Some states, you know, it's like they don't know whether they're contested or not. Some more might be contested this time. They might get a presidential election. And the Electoral College system just gives this absurdly outsized weight to disproportionately white and right-leaning rural states. And, of course, it just openly violates the core democratic principles of majority rule and one person, one vote. Now, when I agreed a while back to come back and do this topic on this date, I thought, well, that'll be fun because I want to talk about this, but it's going to be, I like to work off the news cycle. It's going to be completely off the news cycle, you know? And then actually, this last couple of weeks, the Democratic presidential candidates have started bitching about the Electoral College, interestingly enough. And so it's not completely outside of the news cycle. And it's been fascinating to watch cable news and see right-wing Republican experts come up, because that's what you do in cable news. You get the Democrat over here and the Republican over there, and that's the whole spectrum, the right and the left. And to actually see the right-wing Republican guys actually get up there and just say flat out, that's, we're not a democracy, and the founders didn't want us to be, and we shouldn't be. And the funny thing about it is that the line from Trump and the Republicans is that thanks to the Electoral College, there's an election in the whole country. That's what they say. They go, the small states would be completely, you know, ignored, and we'd only focus on the big cities. And it's just complete nonsense. It's the exact opposite. They're saying 2 + 2 = 5 there. Because of the Electoral College and its winner-take-all electoral system and the partisan geographic polarization of the states now, where you can just write them off, we actually have a presidential election in 15 states at most. The Senate, I love the Senate apportionment system. It's even more skewed to the right. And I'm talking about this, every state gets 2 senators no matter what population they have. It's just Monty Python-esque. It's darkly humorous. The 2% of Americans who live in the nation's 9 smallest states have the same amount of senatorial representation as the 51% of Americans who live in the nation's 9 largest states. Red Wyoming, I love this, home to 573,720 people, holds U.S. senatorial parity with Blue California, where more than 39 American millions reside. That's 1 senator for every 19.5 million Californians versus 1 senator for every 278,000 Wyomingians. What's a Wyomingian? I don't know. Let's say a Wyoming resident. A Wyomingian. Talk about a rotten borough system. You know, they still have rotten boroughs in the British House of Lords. Speaking of boroughs, just 1 of New York City's 5 boroughs, Brooklyn, slated to be home of the Left Forum this year, has 2.6 million people. If Brooklyn, one of New York City's 5 boroughs, were a state and U.S. senators were apportioned there at the same population to senator ratio as Wyoming, Brooklyn would have 9 U.S. senators. And I'm thinking in Brooklyn, it's unlikely that a single one of them would be a Republican. Now, the same goes for Chicago, which is home to 2.7 million people. You know, Brooklyn and Chicago are like the same size. The Chicago metropolitan area is 9.5 million people. If it enjoyed Wyoming's population to senator ratio, Chicagoland would have 17 U.S. senators. I mean, think about that. That'd be like one person, one vote, right? Which is like the, one of the core elementary baseline definitions of democracy is one person, one vote. I'll get even crazier here. The following 13 states have a combined population of 34.4 million. Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Nebraska, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Utah, and good old Wyoming. Together, these 13 red states send 26 Republicans to the U.S. Senate. Now, granted, those numbers are before the last midterm elections. I did crunch those numbers before that. There might be I might be one off. I doubt it, though. The single state of California with a population more than 5 million higher than those 13 states combined, of course, sends two Democratic senators to our House of Lords, the U.S. Senate. This apportionment system means that the Republican Senate majority answers to a very disproportionately white, rural, and reactionary section of the electorate, and due to a population shift from the agricultural interior to crowded corridors along the coast, it is now at least mathematically possible to cobble together a Senate majority with states that account for just 17.6% of the popular.
And my apologies for interrupting this extraordinary lesson in higher mathematics by independent, radical democratic policy researcher, teacher, journalist, historian and author, Paul Street. There are more intriguing equations about the U.S. Senate in the conclusion of this talk. Paul Street spoke in March 2019 at the Open University of the Left in Chicago, and I hope you can come back when TUC Radio returns. Paul Street has authored 7 books to date, among them, Racial Oppression in the Global Metropolis, A Living Black Chicago History, and They Rule, The 1% Versus Democracy. Paul Street's essays and commentaries have appeared in a wide variety of media, such as Counterpunch, Truth Dig, Black Agenda Report, The New York Times, and CNN, to name only a few. Credit for the recording of Paul Street goes to Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio in Chicago. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.